Chapter 18. I have the smallpox, and prepare to leave Castlewood. When Harry Esmond passed through the crisis of that malady, and returned to health again, he found that little Frank Esmond had also suffered, and rallied after the disease, and the lady his mother was down with it, with a couple more of the household. Tea was a providence, for which we all ought to be thankful, Dr. Tusher said, that my lady and her son were spared, while death carried off the poor domestics of the house, and rebuked Harry for asking, in his simple way, for which we ought to be thankful, that the servants were killed, or the gentlefolks were saved. Nor could young Esmond agree in the doctor's vehement protestations to my lady, when he visited her during her convalescence, that the malady had not in the least impaired her charms, and had not been churl enough, to injure the fair features of the Viscountess of Castlewood. Whereas, in spite of these fine speeches, Harry thought that her ladyship's beauty was very much injured by the smallpox. When the marks of the disease cleared away, they did not, it is true, leave furrows or scars on her face, except one, perhaps, on her forehead over her left eyebrow, but the delicacy of her rosy color and complexion was gone. Her eyes had lost their brilliancy, her hair fell, and her face looked older. It was as if a coarse hand had rubbed off the delicate tints of that sweet picture, and brought it, as one has seen unskillful painting cleaners do, to the dead color. Also, it must be owned, that for a year or two after the malady, her ladyship's nose was swollen and redder. There would be no need to mention these trivialities, but that they actually influenced many lives, as trifles will in the world, where a gnat often plays a greater part than an elephant, and a molehill, as we know in King William's case, can upset an empire. When Tusher in his courtly way, at which Harry Esmond always chafed, and spoke scornfully, vowed and protested, that my lady's face was none the worse, the lad broke out and said, "It is worse, and my mistress is not near so handsome as she was," on which poor Lady Castlewood gave a rueful smile, and a look into a little Venice glass he had, which showed her, I suppose, that what the stupid boy said was only too true, for she turned away from the glass, and her eyes filled with tears. The sight of these in Esmond's heart always created a sort of rage of pity, and seeing them on the face of the lady whom he loved best, the young blunderer sank down on his knees, and besought her to pardon him, saying that he was a fool and an idiot, that he was a brute, to make such a speech, he who had caused her malady. And Dr. Tusher told him, that a bear he was indeed, and a bear he would remain, at which speech poor young Esmond was so dumbstricken, that he did not even growl. He is my bear, and I will not have him baited, doctor, my lady said, patting her hand kindly on the boy's head, as he was still kneeling at her feet. How your hair has come off! And mine too, she added with another sigh. It is not for myself that I cared, my lady said to Harry, when the parson had taken his leave, but am I very much changed? Alas! I fear 'tis too true. Madam, you have the dearest, and kindest, and sweetest face in the world, I think, the lad said, and indeed he thought and thinks so. Will my lord think so when he comes back? The lady asked with a sigh, and another look at her Venice glass. Suppose he should think as you do, sir, that I am hideous. Yes, you said hideous. He will cease to care for me. 'Tis all men care for in women, our little beauty. Why did he select me from among my sisters? 'Twas only for that. We reign but for a day or two. And be sure, that Vashti knew Esther was coming. Madam, said Mr. Esmond, Ahasuerus was the Grand Turk, and to change, was the manner of his country, and according to his law. You are all Grand Turks for that matter, said my lady, or would be if you could. Come, Frank, come, my child. You are well, praised be heaven. Your locks are not thinned by this dreadful smallpox. Nor your poor face scarred, is it, my angel? Frank began to shout, and whimper at the idea of such a misfortune. From the very earliest time the young lord had been taught to admire his beauty by his mother, and esteemed it as highly as any reigning toast valued hers. One day, as he himself was recovering from his fever and illness, a pang of something like shame shot across young Esmond's breast, as he remembered that he had never once during his illness given a thought to the poor girl at the Smiley, whose red cheeks, but a month ago he had been so eager to see. Poor Nancy! Her cheeks had shared the fate of roses, and were withered now. As he had taken the illness on the same day with Esmond, she and her brother were both dead of the smallpox, and buried under the Castlewood yew trees. There was no bright face looking now from the garden, or to cheer the old smith at his lonely fireside. Esmond would have liked to have kissed her in her shroud, like the lass in Mr. Prior's pretty poem, but she rested many a foot below the ground, when Esmond after his malady first trod on it. Dr. Tusher brought the news of this calamity, about which Harry Esmond longed to ask, but did not like. He said almost the whole village had been stricken with the pestilence. 17 persons were dead of it, among them mentioning the names of poor Nancy and her little brother. He did not fail to say how thankful we survivors ought to be. It being this man's business to flatter and make sermons, it must be owned he was most industrious in it, and was doing the one or the other all day. And so Nancy was gone, and Harry Esmond blushed that he had not a single tear for her, and fell to composing an elegy in Latin verses over the rustic little beauty. He bade the dryads mourn and the river nymphs deplore her. As her father followed the calling of Vulcan, he said that surely she was like a daughter of Venus, though Sivrite's wife was an ugly shrew, as he remembered to have heard afterwards. He made a long face, but, in truth, felt scarcely more sorrowful than a mute at a funeral. These first passions of men and women are mostly abortive, and are dead, almost before they are born. Esmond could repeat, to his last day, some of the doggerel lines in which his muse bewailed his pretty lass, not without shame to remember how bad the verses were, and how good he thought them, how false the grief, and yet how he was rather proud of it. 'Tis an error, surely, to talk of the simplicity of youth. I think no persons are more hypocritical, and have a more affected behavior to one another, than the young. They deceive themselves and each other with artifices that do not impose upon men of the world, and so we get to understand truth better, and grow simpler as we grow older. When my lady heard of the fate which had befallen poor Nancy, she said nothing so long as Tusher was by, but when he was gone, she took Harry Esmond's hand and said, "Harry, I beg your pardon for those cruel words I used on the night you were taken ill. I am shocked at the fate of the poor creature, and am sure that nothing had happened of that with which, in my anger, I charged you. And the very first day we go out, you must take me to the blacksmith, and we must see if there is anything I can do to console the poor old man. Poor man! To lose both his children! What should I do without mine?" And this was, indeed, the very first walk which my lady took, leaning on Esmond's arm, after her illness. But her visit brought no consolation to the old father, and he showed no softness, or desire to speak. "He lord gave and took away," he said, "and he knew what his servant's duty was. He wanted for nothing less now than ever before, as there were fewer mouths to feed. He wished her ladyship and Master Esmond good morning. He had grown tall in his illness, and was but very little marked, and with this, and a surly bow, he went in from the Smiley to the house, leaving my lady, somewhat silenced and shamefaced, at the door. He had a handsome stone put up for his two children, which may be seen in Castlewood churchyard to this very day, and before a year was out his own name was upon the stone. In the presence of death, that sovereign ruler, a woman's coquetry is seared, and her jealousy will hardly pass the boundaries of that grim kingdom. 'Tis entirely of the earth, that passion, and expires in the cold blue air, beyond our sphere. At length, when the danger was quite over, it was announced that my lord and his daughter would return. Esmond well remembered the day. The lady, his mistress, was in a flurry of fear. Before my lord came, she went into her room, and returned from it with reddened cheeks. Her fate was about to be decided. Her beauty was gone. Was her reign too over? A minute would say. My lord came riding over the bridge. He could be seen from the great window, clad in scarlet, and mounted on his gray hackney. His little daughter ambled by him in a bright riding dress of blue, on a shining chestnut horse. My lady leaned against the great mantelpiece, looking on, with one hand on her heart. She seemed only the more pale for those red marks on either cheek. She put her handkerchief to her eyes, and withdrew it, laughing hysterically. The cloth was quite red with the rouge when she took it away. She ran to her room again, and came back with pale cheeks and red eyes, her son in her hand, just as my lord entered, accompanied by young Esmond, who had gone out to meet his protector, and to hold his stirrup as he descended from horseback. "What, Harry, boy," my lord said, good-naturedly, "you look as gaunt as a greyhound. The smallpox hasn't improved your beauty, and your side of the house hadn't never too much of it, ho, ho." And he laughed, and sprang to the ground with no small agility, looking handsome and red, within a jolly face and brown hair, like a beefeater. Esmond, kneeling again, as soon as his patron had descended, performed his homage, and then went to greet the little Beatrix, and help her from her horse. "Fie, how yellow you look," she said, "and there are one, two, red holes in your face," which, indeed, was very true. Harry Esmond's harsh countenance bearing, as long as it continued to be a human face, the marks of the disease. My lord laughed again, in high good humor. "Did," said he, with one of his usual oaths, "the little slut sees everything. She saw the dowager's paint t'other day, and asked her why she wore that red stuff, didn't you, Trix? And the tower, and St. James, and the play, and the Prince George, and the Princess Anne, didn't you, Trix? They are both very fat, and smelt of brandy," the child said. Papa roared with laughing. "Brandy," he said. "Andy, how do you know, Miss Pert?" "Because your lordship smells of it after supper, when I embrace you before you go to bed," said the young lady, who, indeed, was as pert as her father said, and looked as beautiful a little gypsy as eyes ever gazed on. "And now for my lady," said my lord, going up the stairs, and passing under the tapestry curtain that hung before the drawing-room door. Esmond remembered that noble figure, handsomely arrayed in scarlet. Within the last few months he himself had grown from a boy to be a man, and with his figure his thoughts had shot up, and grown manly. My lady's countenance, of which Harry Esmond was accustomed to watch the changes, and with a solicitous affection to note and interpret the signs of gladness or care, wore a sad and depressed look for many weeks after her lord's return, during which it seemed as if, by caresses and entreaties, she strove to win him back from some ill humor he had, and which he did not choose to throw off. In her eagerness to please him, she practiced a hundred of those arts which had formerly charmed him, but which seemed now to have lost their potency. Her songs did not amuse him, and she hushed them, and the children when in his presence. My lord sat silent at his dinner, drinking greatly, his lady opposite to him, looking furtively at his face, though also speechless. Her silence annoyed him as much as her speech, and he would peevishly, and with an oath, ask her why she held her tongue and looked so glum, or he would roughly check her when speaking, and bid her not talk nonsense. It seemed as if, since his return, nothing she could do or say could please him. When a master and mistress are at strife in a house, the subordinates in the family take the one side or the other. Harry Esmond stood in so great fear of my lord, that he would run a league barefoot to do a message for him, but his attachment for Lady Esmond was such a passion of grateful regard, that to spare her a grief, or to do her a service, he would have given his life daily. And it was by the very depth and intensity of this regard that he began to divine how unhappy his adored lady's life was, and that a secret care, for she never spoke of her anxieties, was weighing upon her. Can anyone, who has passed through the world and watched the nature of men and women there, doubt what had befallen her? I have seen, To be sure, some people carry down with them into old age the actual bloom of their youthful love, and I know that Mr. Thomas Parr lived to be 160 years old. But, for all that, 70 is the age of men, and few get beyond it, and 'tis certain that a man who marries for mere beaux, as my lord did, considers this part of the contract at an end, when the woman ceases to fulfill hers, and his love does not survive her beauty. I know 'tis often otherwise, I say, and can think, as most men in their own experience may, of many a house, where, lighted in early years, the sainted lamp of love hath never been extinguished. But so there is Mr. Parr, and so there is the great giant at the fair, that is 8 feet high exceptions to men, and that poor lamp whereof I speak, that lights at first the nuptial chamber, is extinguished by 100 winds and drafts down the chimney, or sputters out for want of feeding. And then it is clo, in the dark, stark awake, and Strephon snoring unheeding, or vice versa, 'tis poor Strephon, that has married a heartless jilt, and awoke out of that absurd vision of conjugal felicity, which was to last forever, and is over like any other dream. One and other has made his bed, and so must lie in it, until that final day when life ends, and they sleep separate. About this time young Esmond, who had a knack of stringing verses, turned some of Ovid's epistles into rhymes, and brought them to his lady for her delectation. Those which treated of forsaken women touched her immensely, Harry remarked. And when Enon called after Paris, and Medea bade Jason come back again, the lady of Castlewood sighed, and said she thought that part of the verses was the most pleasing. Indeed, she would have chopped up the dean, her old father, in order to bring her husband back again. But her beautiful Jason was gone, as beautiful Jasons will go, and the poor enchantress had never a spell to keep him. My lord was only sulky, as long as his wife's anxious face or behavior seemed to upbraid him. When as he had got to master these, and to show an outwardly cheerful countenance and behavior, her husband's good humor returned partially, and he swore and stormed no longer at dinner, but laughed sometimes, and yawned unrestrainedly, absenting himself often from home, inviting more company thither, passing the greater part of his days in the hunting field, or over the bottle as before. But with this difference, that the poor wife could no longer see now, as he had done formerly, the light of love kindled in his eyes. He was with her, but that flame was out, and that once welcome beacon no more shone there. What were this lady's feelings, when forced to admit the truth whereof her foreboding glass had given her only too true warning, that within her beauty her reign had ended, and the days of her love were over? What does a seaman do in a storm, if mast and rudder are carried away? He ships a jury mast, and steers as he best can with an oar. What happens if your roof falls in a tempest? After the first stun of the calamity the sufferer starts? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.